Okay. So I'm going to follow up from David's talk and actually talk a little bit about data analysis and thoughts we have about different signals, in particular focusing on the R modes, but also thinking a little bit about other periodic sources. The nature of the talk is not very technical in terms of describing algorithms and getting into big details that you guys probably aren't interested in, but I do want to try and emphasize what we need to know as people who are looking at the data and what you can give us to try and go and look for these signals in the data stream. So the organization of the talk is as follows. I'll start out by, well, the first thing I'm going to do is just draw, is put up again the sensitivity plot that you saw Bob Wagner put up this morning and point out the different sources and where they lie. Tell you a little bit more about that plot as well at the time. Then I'm going to remind you about how we go about detecting weak signals in a noisy data stream. Move on from there and explain why it is that the R mode problem, so if there are R modes and if our state of knowledge remains as it currently is, why that is actually a difficult data analysis task. When I've done that, then I'll give you some ideas of the real sensitivities of the instruments when you include the data analysis algorithms, and just comment on how many sources we might expect and what science we might be able to do. And then I'll finish by just, again, reminding you what it is we'd like from theorists in order to go ahead and do maybe a better job of looking for these signals in the data stream. So you saw this plot a little bit earlier today, and this shows the sensitivity plots for what used to be the initial, which is LIGO 1, the enhanced, which is LIGO 2, and the advanced interferometers in the LIGO facilities. The plots here, I want to stress what these things are. What they correspond to is the threshold amplitude, so just raw threshold strain, raw strain that you have, the threshold amplitude such that there is a 1% a priori probability that detector noise alone will produce an event above these curves in the data analysis process. These curves here correspond to an observation time of 10 to the 7 seconds. And the way we've done this is that what you plot for a signal is, as I say, the instantaneous strain amplitude, whereas the noise decreases, the noise amplitude decreases as 1 over root t. So these curves are for 10 to the 7 seconds, and they're under the assumption that you know exactly what the frequency and phase evolution of the signal is. So you don't have any unknown parameters whatsoever. You know exactly what the signal does during your observation. So if you do this, you've got a few nice signals or sources that you can look at here. There's the Crab and the Vela pulsars under assumptions that their spin down is completely due to gravitational wave emission. Highly unlikely, so these are upper limits. You want to come down quite a bit, probably a couple of orders of magnitude there. The other thing you have, well, this is unknown pulsars. This line here is unknown pulsars in the galaxy, supposedly isolated, and epsilon characterizes the gravitational ellipticity, so basically how football-shaped they are. For epsilon 10 to the minus 5, which is about the maximum gravitational ellipticity that can be supported by the crust, you get this type of strain here. Finally, the other two things that are interesting and are the focus of this meeting are R modes. And you've got two lines here which are of interest. The first one is the R modes at about 2 megaparsecs. So it's this line here. And here's the R modes at 20 megaparsecs. Clearly, this just scales as 1 over the distance, so you can just scale anything you want in here. What you can see is that with LIGO 1, if you take a look at LIGO 1 here, you can only get out to a couple of megaparsecs if you knew exactly what the signal was. Okay. With the enhanced interferometer in broadband configuration, you end up in a position where you can get out a little bit further. You get towards the 20 megaparsec distance, but it's not actually that far. It's more like 8 megaparsecs is what you're sensitive to. I'll discuss this again in detail later on. There's one other curve that's worth pointing out here, and that is the signal recycled noise curve. So this is what David emphasized for the LIGO 2 proposal. And this particular curve has been tuned specifically to try and search for gravitational waves at a frequency of around 500 or 600 hertz. So the idea is to basically look for gravitational waves from LMXBs such as SCOEX1. And as you can see, if you do take advantage of this tuning, you get a significant gain in signal-to-noise ratio, which is basically the amount by which these curves for the sources are above these noise curves. Right? So there is a great deal to be gained in this. But again, let me emphasize, these particular curves are if you knew exactly what the phase and frequency evolution was. The data analysis problem is much more complicated than that. Well, it's not area in this case, right? Because it's effectively a periodic source, right? And so it's not area, it's just height, it's just the ratio of the two numbers. It gives you an estimate of the signal to noise ratio. So the thing is, the characteristic strain here is a different strain. It's a different definition than the one that's used for the broadband noise, for the estimation of signal to noise in the broadband cases. The reason is simply that you don't have an area under a point. Okay, and you just have to look at it differently. And when you rephrase it, you basically end up in a circumstance where you take the ratio HC of the... No, it's not. It's not. That's just to give you an idea of where the instantaneous amplitude is as a function of frequency. Okay. Yeah, so if you want to get a signal-to-noise ratio... So the question is, you know, at which one of these frequencies is the length of time for it to change by order unity in frequency? How long is that? When you're down around this frequency band, you're around a year. Okay, so they roughly stay constant for a year. So you're well okay on the 10 to the 7 second as constant frequency source. Yeah. Okay, so, and I didn't have the noise curves for this, so that is a good point. So for GEO, which will come online in the next year or so, if you draw a straight line across here, they can actually do the signal recycling tuning in such a way that the bottom of their noise curve will sit roughly on a straight line across here. Okay, and so that's, will it dip a little? Oh, two-year, okay. So 2 year gives you a factor of root 6, which is, yeah. So actually, let me move ahead and give you. I'm going to replot these curves based on what we can achieve with realistic computing power. So we'll come back to this again. But Bernie's point is particularly important. And that is to remember that if you're thinking about sources, GEO can narrowband and so can move the bottom of its sensitivity curve. So, do you need? Did I turn it off? Thanks, David. Okay, so as I say, I'll come back to those curves again probably near the end, but for now let me move on and tell you a little bit, just remind you, actually most of you are well aware of this, but let me remind you how you dig weak signals out of noisy data. So the basic idea is that if you start with noisy data stream, and it really doesn't matter too much what the noise characteristics are, as long as you have a situation where the data stream corresponds to additive noise and plus a signal that you're looking for, which is here h of t, what you find is that in the limit, the best way, in the limit of very weak signals, the best way to go looking for the signals is using match filtering. And as an example, what I wanted to do was just consider searching for a sinusoidal signal that's buried in some sort of noise, and just think about how you'd normally do this. So we all know what you'd do is you take a Fourier transform of the data stream, then you'd compute its power, the power in the Fourier transform, and you'd search across the frequency band and look for a spike. So what's really happening here is that what you're actually doing is you know the signal is sinusoidal, so what you do is you multiply your data stream by the signal that you expect, like this, pointwise, okay, and then you sum up over the time. In this particular case, if you're looking for a signal which is sinusoidal but you don't know any information about the frequency, then what you have to do is you have to include different frequencies in this coefficient that you multiply your data stream by. Okay? So for some given frequency, which is here the discrete form frequency k and fk on here, what you find is that you multiply by these things and sum them up. The FFT gives us a quick way of doing this calculation so that we can actually, for a fairly cheap method, explore all possible values of k in a given range. Okay? But the real thing that's going on here is that you're doing match filtering at different frequencies across your bandwidth. Right? And you have to check it for different values of k. Right? So that's rather important. What happens in this case is also pretty easy to understand, or is important for the detection algorithm, and that is fairly simple. What we have here is that if you match the frequency of the input signal, so the quantity you multiply by, this is your template waveform, as Bob was saying earlier, if you match that with the frequency of your sinusoidal signal that's in the data stream, then you find that the signal part gets summed up coherently. We all know that you just overlay two sine waves, sum up the squares of all the points. Okay. Then the next thing is, however, that the noise is incoherently summed. And when you take a look at this, what you find is that the power signal to noise ratio from your signal is increasing as the observation time. So the power increases as the observation time. That's why the sensitivity plots, as I showed, depend on the observation time. Now, the goal in the data analysis problem is clearly, for a lot of these sources, they're very long-lived. They're of order a year, at least, if you think about R modes. If you think about other things, they could be there for thousands of years. And so we can treat them as basically continuous. So what we want to do in our detection algorithms is we want to compute templates. We want to multiply them by the time series like this and sum up the power, compute a signal-to-noise ratio, and look for the source. But we have to do that for all possible different unknowns in the signal. So what does that mean for the case of the R modes? Well, let's take a look at what we know, what seems to be state of the art, as far as I can tell, about R modes. What we know is that the signals last of order a year. And we also know that they sweep down in frequency from somewhere around a kilohertz, that's just roughly, down to somewhere around 100 or 200 hertz. So that's basically what we know. We have a fairly good model, we have a reasonable estimate of how the evolution might go in terms of the frequency evolution, but it's by no means constrained fully. And in particular, what I need to emphasize is what we mean by constraint in this case, and that's the following. If you want to use an optimal filter to search for any signal, what you need is you need to track the frequency or the phase evolution of the signal very accurately. How accurately must you track it? Well, if your observation time is of order a year, or 10 to the 7 seconds, to give you an idea here, then you have to be able to track that frequency to of order 10 to the minus 7 hertz accuracy. That's just very crude. Okay, but that gives you an idea of how accurately you need to know your signal over the entire bandwidth of the evolution. Now, the point is that I think based on any of the issues that have been discussed so far, and I'm sure there'll be lots more as we go through the meeting, there are any number of possible influences on the evolution of the gravitational wave, the frequency of the gravitational wave, that have not been accounted for yet. And they all have timescales of order years, tens of years, or hundreds of years. They are going to be significant for the evolution of the frequency in the R-mode case. So what can we do in order to try and go look for it? Well, Bob's already touched on the first thing. The first thing you can try and do is introduce some sort of parameterized model where you can tune the parameters. And so you can explore all possible values of the parameters in some physical parameter space that is defined by you guys. In the absence of having that, at the present time, what we have done, just to get a ballpark estimate of what you can do with something like LIGO, is we've just said, well, let's just suppose that the phase evolves according to a power law formula, something like this. So this is not at all tied in with any phenomenology yet. It's just a power law evolution. And we do then take something from what the papers that have been written so far. And the first thing is that the frequency, the F0 that appears outside here, is of order a kilohertz. The other thing that we take is that, well, most of the signal-to-noise ratio is accumulated near the end of the R-mode evolution. So it's near the end of a 3-month to a year-long period. And the time scale for change of frequency is of order 1 year in that case. And so each of the coefficients in this power law, in this polynomial time here for the phase, actually behave like 1 over that time scale to the power of k. So f sub k here, by the way, is no longer frequency. This is something that it does have dimensions of frequency, but it's just coefficients in this series. So we have some list of coefficients, F1, F2, F3, F4, F5, all of which, all we know about them is that those coefficients are bounded above by this number here. But we have to search all possible values between 0 and this number for each of the coefficients and all possible curves that actually occur as a result of that. So it's this problem that if we try and actually do this, so you pick a set of values of fk, that gives you a template, you multiply it against your time series, you construct a signal-to-noise ratio, you ask whether or not there's any spike in it, because you get it as a function of frequency, and then you don't find something, then you go back and choose a new set of fk, do the same thing, and look for signals again. And it's the fact that you have to keep doing that same calculation over and over again many, many times, sampling different values of fk, that causes problems in terms of how hard it or how easy it is to detect signals. So basically, for what we've done, we've treated a as constant. We haven't taken into account the f to the minus 3 that actually does appear in that for the R modes. Okay, we haven't done that. Optimal filtering should account for that. The model we've done is simply to just track the phase and not put in the weighting and the amplitude. Absolutely. Yeah. And there are other issues here as well. I mean, that's the f to the minus 7/3. There's another issue here which is not accounted for as well, and that is the fact that the detector is actually anisotropic. It doesn't have a uniform response function. It's moving in time. If you observe for longer than a few hours, your response function changes, and so this amplitude picks up time-dependent factors which are actually due to the response function of the detector. We haven't accounted for that either. That's going to modulate your signal further and actually introduce further problems. Effectively. It's effectively constant on the time scale of the observation, which is of order a year. Point is, it takes up order a year for the frequency to change by an amount of order unity. And so it's effectively constant for this. Actually, sorry, let me be careful. Sorry, I may not have said that correctly. You don't assume, so it's not assumed to be, the frequency not assumed to be absolutely constant because you're tracking the phase with these parameters, right? But in terms of the amplitude, it's assumed to be effectively constant. Okay, so given that we have some parameterized model, what can we do? What limits the depth of the search that we can do? Well, there are two things, one of which I haven't mentioned here, and that's the first one is, and it's pretty obvious actually, it's basically that we do make an assumption that when we take data, we analyze the data in something of order the same amount of time as it took to take the data. So there's no point in taking data for a year, taking 100 years to analyze it when LIGO 2 is going to come online in 2005. Okay, so we make this assumption that we can analyze roughly in the same time as it takes to take the data stream. And that's rather important, because that's really where the constraint thing comes in on how deep you can go. So given that, it's the computational requirements that are needed to perform the match filtering for all the different values of fk which really limit the depth of the search, under the assumption that we perform the analysis in the same time as it took to take the data. The cost of each matched filter, so for a given sample set fk, the cost of each matched filter is effectively an FFT. It's not much else. So for any particular single set of parameters, we can do this really quickly. The trouble is that the number of parameters that you end up exploring goes up really, really quickly with the length of the observation time, and you can end up in the region of having to do like of order 10 to the 10 or more different template waveforms. So you have to do many, many matched filters. As a result of this, when you go through and you just do naive numbers, go through and compute it, what you find is brute force, matched filter, calculate signal-to-noise ratio, you just can't do it. You can't get any decent sensitivity by doing that. So what you do is you go back and you change your algorithm a little bit to try and take advantage of some other things that go on. In particular, the real thing that really gives you a good gain is to do a multi-stage search. So you go in, you do a search where you don't very accurately match your parameters, you look for signals, and then you follow up candidates in a deeper search later on. So you do two-stage hierarchical search, or maybe multi-stage hierarchical search. The other trick that we're using, or at least the people who are developing the data analysis algorithms are using, is a trick of using short FFTs in which signal-to-noise ratio is coherently accumulated, but then adding together, essentially, the power from another FFT slightly later, another FFT slightly later, another FFT slightly later. Okay, that way, what you do is you do still beat the noise down, but you just don't beat it down as quickly as you would by doing a coherent transform over the long observation time. When you do this, the answer for the threshold depends on a few things. So this is the sensitivity. This here you can think of as your raw strain that you're going to be sensitive to. It's not quite. There's a small factor of order unity out front. But this is the raw strain you're going to be sensitive to. I just want to mention the different numbers are here because I'm going to show you a table in a moment. N is the number of these incoherent transforms that you add up. Rho C is a threshold sensitivity, so that's just a signal-to-noise ratio threshold. And SN is the noise curve for the instrument that you're dealing with. This factor here, which is explained in detail, is a factor which takes account of this fact that the detector orientation is changing with time, and so you can roughly average over all locations on the sky to get an effect of how it beats down the signal-to-noise. And delta T here is the length of each individual small Fourier transform. The quantity that we use then to measure how well we're doing is a ratio of the H3 per year, which is the sensitivity curves which I showed you at the very first transparency. So they're 10 to the 7 second integration times. The ratio of that number to the threshold sensitivity computed in this way. And this is including all the match filtering and things like that into the search. No, rho sub c does.
Okay. I'm a little perplexed by that because I'm asking the question of the radio poll.
Okay.
Community, is it true to say then that you have a 1% wall alarm rate?
In actual fact, for this search, that would not be completely true. We make an assumption in this calculation is to estimate for the overall search, to estimate the false alarm probability. We assume that every possible template is independent. We just make that assumption from the beginning. The point is that under that assumption, it's not completely true. It's not necessarily a 1% over the entire template bank. Yes. Yeah. So in fact, the 10 to the minus 1, so the 10 to the, well, the trials are accounted for in the row. Okay, so the threshold, the number of trials are accounted for. Okay. No. No, no, no. No, it means after the 10 to the 9 trials, you have 1% probability of having a false alarm. Yeah. It's, but, well, it is and it isn't, but the thing is, we account for after doing all trials, at the very end, the probability of a single false alarm is of order 1%. It's not quite exactly 1% due to the non-independence, but it's of that order. So, okay. So, when you do this and you try to optimize your search based on the fixed amount of computational power that you might be able to throw at the search, you can get out the end this relative, this sensitivity, which is that ratio of those two numbers that I showed you, and actually start to talk about how well you do compared to the noise, compared to the sensitivity plots that I showed at the beginning of the talk. Okay, under the assumption of analyzing the data in the same amount of time, and under the assumption that you only have a fixed amount of computing power to throw at the problem. The parameters that we allowed to adjust are, we have a two-stage hierarchical search here in this table. So parameters that are allowed to be adjusted in this particular thing are the number of short FFTs you stack up and the length of each one of them in each level of the search. And in fact, we held this quantity here is really to do with how well you would how well a match filter would pick out a signal even if there was no noise present. Okay. There's this. That's what this factor is. I don't want to go into details of it right now, but just mention that it is there. Now, when you do this, what you find is that for something like a teraflop of computing power, which is not out of the question these days, but is pretty hard to get as at a sustained data throughput, you would want to analyze roughly 5 short FFTs stacked together, each of them about a day long, in the first stage of the search, and 8, a little more than a day, day and a quarter long, in the second stage of the search. And so when you look at that, you're roughly up around the level of wanting to have about 15 days worth of data that you'd analyze in order to get the best sensitivity out this end. Okay? So for a fixed computational power, the algorithm's held fixed, you go in, you optimize this theta, and what you find is that you can only get to within 10% of the sensitivity curves that I showed in the first place. Now, you're going to ask me right away, well, we've got 3 years worth of data, assuming that we do the extra year science run. What are we doing with the rest of it? We've only analyzed 15 days. Well, what we do with the rest of it is we keep analyzing it, and we basically add on hierarchical steps to the search ad infinitum until we can actually establish as much confidence as possible in the detection that we get. Computing what the ultimate sensitivity is based on that type of algorithm is really, really difficult in any theoretical sense. And so I can't quote numbers for that at the present time. Another thing that's important here, however, is the following. Suppose you are only analyzing 15 days worth of data, or some reasonably small subset of all the science data. You might then decide that, well, okay, we can take 10 times as long to analyze the whole data set. We're not worried. We're going to take 15 days, so let's take half a year or a year to analyze it. Well, then, to get roughly how much better you do, you can just scale this number by the factor that you say in time. And that would bring you up to the 10 teraflop level, which is still only 0.1%. So as you can see, by taking a lot longer to analyze the same amount of data, you don't actually gain much in terms of sensitivity. What you really need to do is either beat down the noise curve or, in some sense, add in more layers into your analysis program, which reduce the computational cost. So the bottom line, then, for optimal sensitivity, assuming you've got a computational power, so this is real throughput of data from the interferometers, the sensitivity curves for a few different searches are shown here. The first one is the R-mode one, I'm assuming a teraflop, and it shows you roughly what you get. To figure out how far you can see to, you can roughly normalize to the top of this line here. That's roughly true. And so what you find is that with LIGO 1, well, you're not going to see these things out beyond a megaparsec. Okay. With LIGO 2, when you go in and you take a look, you can probably see out to, with the broadband configuration, you can probably see out to about eight megaparsecs. That's very rough. It's not accurate by any means, but it's roughly right. The other thing that's of interest for people here is the low mass X-ray binaries. Under the assumption that we actually know the phase and orbital evolution very, very, very well, but we don't know things about the accretion process that's actually turning on and off, and so fluctuations that are stochastic in the frequency of the gravitational waves from the source, you can do roughly this well. So with broadband interferometers, you can't really see, you cannot really see the SCOEX one, but with the narrowband one, you can. Okay. So that's important. The last thing, second last thing I want to point out is just a little bit about what this means in terms of the science we can do. Most people here are probably familiar with this, but let me just give you some numbers. The R-mode sources are marginally detectable at out to about 8 megaparsecs with enhanced LIGO interferometers. There is no optimization of the of using signal to recycling at that point. You could gain something, not a lot, I think. Basically, out to that distance, you've got approximately 165 galaxies, roughly like our own. And based on, or rather, 165 galaxies, based on their types, etc., and on published supernova rates, what you find is that the total supernova rate for this type of thing is about 0.6 per year in this volume. Okay. That means that if you 3 years worth of data, of course, you've got 1.8 per year, 1.8 per 3 years, you might get two events if you're really, really lucky. Other problems which arise, and I don't know what you guys can say about this, is the following. There is a breakdown of the types of supernovas. 10% are type 1A, 20% are 1B, 70% are type 2. Okay. Question is, how many of those are likely to produce R-mode on stable neutron stars? So that's another interesting question that comes in. So that's one of the scientific questions that would be nice if you guys could answer as well. Let me, since I've emphasized already that what we need from you is models for the frequency evolution, let me just tell you a little bit about the status of going looking for these things within the LIGO scientific collaboration. This is just hope you can read this. There's not a lot of information on it. Just want to spell it out. The data analysis plans are moving ahead quite well. The LIGO Scientific Collaboration, these are very rough numbers, consists of about 20 institutions and 200 scientists. The whole goal is to analyze the data from the LIGO interferometers and then hopefully also coincident data with GEO and Virgo ultimately as they come online. The search codes that are currently under development and actually should be prepared by summer of 2001. For certain things like the pulsar search codes, that may be a little optimistic since they are still hard problems even in terms of actually getting them working very efficiently. But there will be something available by that time. The analysis procedure within the LSC is being driven by proposals from groups in the LSC and within the LIGO 1 working group. So, and that I believe is frozen at this point. So LIGO 1, it will be a proposal-driven process, and in fact there's discussions in hand at the moment to try and start getting up to speed on actually doing some of these things. But one of the things which again would be very nice to see in this meeting, if you want something else to focus on, is that there is this question of what science is available with LIGO 1 and what science is available with LIGO 2. From things like accreting neutron stars, R-mode unstable neutron stars, and even isolated neutron stars. So that would be a nice, they'd be nice questions to answer and get some idea of during this meeting. So thank you. Yes. Right, which is quite wide compared to the. So it can still, presumably that's roughly a half width, you're expecting something that's roughly peaked like this, if you do it instantaneously, it's roughly got that type of frequency structure. Right. all it can do here is it'll track. It's not optimal. What it will do, what you would do, is you'd be tracking basically the peak part of the instantaneous frequency spectrum. That's what you'd hope to track. Okay. So, but it's not optimal. No. I mean, you should actually do something which would account for the width. But once you start, one of the reasons why at least we've explored this method, and I should emphasize as well that other methods really haven't been explored in terms of actually implementing them to go look for these sources. And the one reason why we explored this method is just that it's computationally less costly than doing real match filtering on them, the way that we implement it. But clearly, things like the width, things that like the fact that we have to explore such a big parameter space, all of these things are actually problems. And we'd like, I guess, a better defined signal. Right, but it will detect stuff that's, yeah. Right, yeah. I don't want to say that this method is not optimal for that strategy, but it should still pick out those type of signals, provided they're quasi-periodic. So, yeah, David. So the numbers that I quoted were based on you basically catching the signal about 3 months after the birth of the neutron star, right? That was when the time scale of evolution was around 1 year. That's somewhere around 300 hertz, I believe. I don't know that those numbers are based on the Limbamon et al. Paper. So if the cutoff starts coming up above 300 hertz, you're going to do worse. You're going to do significantly worse. I can't give you a quote. Well, above 300, you're going to start to cut significantly into this, because every time you come up from the lower end, you do most damage on these signals. I mean, that's the fact of it. Because yes, yeah, because they're in the good sensitivity band, and so you just start coming up, you start just taking out signal to noise ratio very, very quickly. Yes, and that's why. Right. That's the assumption. And as well, basically, you're assuming you're only doing one of these searches during the science run. Well, that seems reasonable given the event rate you've got. So it seems reasonable as a targeted search. Unfortunately, it does mean that if there are a lot of other hidden supernovae. That, mind you, that's primarily in our galaxy. So if one does go off in our galaxy that we don't see, it's unfortunate. We're probably not going to be able to detect it with this type of search, if we don't see it optically, right? Actually, that's true. A question I don't know the answer to is, what sort of accuracy and position will they give? Yeah, none, right? Okay, depends on time delays and how many of them there are, right? David? I think that's to the audience, not to me. So I don't know of any personally, so. Lenny. That's got to be true, because basically you've got this 3-day time frame for the M dot is just too short and just causes you to have too big a change in frequency over the types of observation times we're interested in. If it's completely stochastic, you just go up as some power of the number or something to the power of the number of stacks. And so it just gets huge really, really quickly. If you had some idea at least which direction it was going, you can certainly start to narrow the band. This is true in general. Anything that narrows the band over which you might sort of draw a time frequency track of the signal, anything that narrows that down at all is useful information for these type of searches and will certainly improve the sensitivities. For the LMXBs, that could be very significant. I don't know the numbers off the top of my head. In actual fact, so for the searches, to get the depth of the search, we had communication about this. In fact, yeah, the number I used was the 15 days or whatever in actual fact. But the actual depth of the search is largely insensitive to it, because once it's changing on that sort of day time scale, then you end up that the depth of the search is really just already fairly poor. And it doesn't change much then as a result of that time scale changing. I can't quote the number at you, but this is the depth of the actual search, not a question of how much you have to account for, how often you have to account for it. It just doesn't change much. You get a few percent. Well, this is, I think this is where, again, I mean, if you can make that time scale longer, we're happy. It will certainly buy us something. It's just not clear how much it's going to buy. But the longer you can make it, the better. So if you can tell us something about the transport, then we certainly can, and that you really believe. You know, I mean, I need you to believe it, not just think it's a nice model. Again, you need to know these things. SCOEX-1, I think, is around 10, around a month for that sensitivity. That I can't answer you. We actually just assumed it was fixed. We wanted to get a back of the envelope estimate on how deep the search could go. We assumed we knew it to within the resolution of the search. No, it's not. Yeah. Well, actually, yeah. I mean, it's uncertain to a factor of 2 or 3, probably. You know. So, I mean, I agree, it's not. The thing is that really the accuracy of knowing the frequency. The accuracy of knowing the frequency in this particular case really is only an issue of how you would adjust the signal recycling mirror to look for it. That's where the accuracy of the frequency will come in the way we have talked about the search. There are other ways to do the search where that might not be true, but you get you explore all possible frequencies for the source when you do the search the way that we've come up with. So. No. If you want to adjust your sensitivity curve, yes. No. It's blinded frequency. It's blinded frequency. For the narrow banding of the search. Yeah. Again, if you're only dealing with a month of data for this type of sensitivity, right, you can tune it 4 or 5 times and explore most of the bandwidth very quickly. Right. Well, it's good to know. Some loose change, I guess. So.
Yeah.
Yanchen? Right. So, I honestly, naively, I don't have an answer to it. Right off the top of my head, I don't have an answer to that. I could probably think about it and estimate. The problem does get harder with the length of the length over which you have to look for the signal, because your frequency resolution of your Fourier transforms decreases so much. It gets more stable, but the thing is that your frequency resolution gets much narrower, and so the length of how many of these coefficients you need still increases as the frequency bin width decreases, okay? And so even though your spin down time might be, say, 10 years instead of just 1 year, you still have a competing effect from the narrowing, because your observation is going to be longer, suppose. Then you'd have a competing effect with that. If your observation is going to be longer, that's I mean, another question. I mean, if they get cut off, well, it will be longer. Sorry, pardon me, yeah. So you have these two competing effects. I can't tell you naively what the answer is, but I would. Yeah, you can fix 1 year and do calculate the numbers. I don't know them off the top of my head is the thing. So. Okay. Lunch. Okay, everyone.